and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. Uganda condemns a vote by the European Union compelling the country to delay the development of the proposed East African crude oil pipeline.
This is a very unfortunate and disappointing development. It awakens the culture of neocolonialism and imperialistic tendencies.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa made his first visit to the White House on Friday, where he and U.S. President Joe Biden discussed global security, climate change, trade, food security and health, and African nations' reluctance to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Really welcome the opportunity to be here so that we can extend those relations and we can get more companies to invest in South Africa to create jobs.
And officials in Cameroon say armed separatists have chased several thousand children from schools just days after the students returned to classrooms for the first time in years. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. European Union lawmakers this week voted to pass a resolution that seeks to compel Uganda, Tanzania, and the Total Energies SE to delay development of the proposed East African crude oil pipeline for at least 1 year. The EU says during the one-year period, Uganda and the French oil giant should go back to the drawing board to study an alternative route with less environmental footprint. They also call for an end to human rights violations, including the immediate release of human rights defenders arrested in an arbitrary manner. And they call for prompt, fair, and adequate compensation for those expropriated or deprived of access to their land by the project. The vote came hours after Uganda's members of parliament had labeled an earlier move to block the project as racist and imperialist. Henry Okello Oryem is Uganda's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs. Earlier, I reached him by phone in Kampala for his reaction.
This is a very unfortunate and disappointing development. It awakens the culture of neocolonialism and imperialistic tendencies that we have been fighting for since independence. I believe that this resolution is based on total ignorance. And I keep saying that the Europeans, after having conquered Africa for over 200 years of colonizing us, and up to today, after 50 years after independence, these Europeans have never ever understood us and never ever appreciated what Africa stands for. We are totally disappointed, and we condemn in no uncertain terms, and we refuse in all possible languages in Africa what that resolution stands for.
The members of the European Union Parliament point out that they want that delay. They are concerned about environmental footprint, environmental issues. What does the Uganda government say about that?
But the Europeans and the Americans, the Europeans are the biggest polluters of the environment as of today. Africa contributes only contributes 3% of the carbon emissions in the world. Yet we contribute 30% of the world population. The Europeans, with 10% of the world population, is responsible for 25% of the global emissions. We, Africa, who are only 20% of the world population, are only responsible for 3% of the global emissions. So what exactly are we talking about? This is a very minute project compared to the huge industrial projects that are ongoing in Western Europe. Very, very minor. This, to us, the intention, the motive, is not about the environment, it's not about human rights. This is another attempt by this imperialistic country, this ignorant European members of parliament who are doing everything possible to suppress Africa's opportunity to develop and become a first world country like theirs.
They also call for an end to human rights violations, including the immediate release of human rights defenders arrested in an arbitrary manner, according to them. And they call for the prompt and fair and adequate compensation for those
Let them give us the names of these individuals. You don't generalize and call names of individuals and tell about the human rights. We Africans also have many cases of human rights against these Europeans. But we don't spend our life on these matters. Why don't they spend their time and resolution on the issue of hunger in Africa, and the issue of poverty in Africa, and the need for access to education, access to medicine, and those kind of things? This is what they should spend their time on if they want to help Africa. Passing resolutions on how we can deal with the issue of climate change impact, bring hunger in Africa, how we can help Africa in making sure that Africa, every African child has every access to decent education, decent health, and so on and so forth. But to dwell on issues which have got nothing to do with our relationship and things which they are equally culpable for is unacceptable.
The company that is a partner in this project is a French company. What do you think this resolution means as far as that company is concerned in completing this project?
Well, it's very unfortunate that this Total, whom they're targeting for, is being put under enormous pressure to pull out. So this project has been ongoing for almost last 10 years. And until recently, last year, Total finally signed what they call FIT, the financial investment decision. I wonder what all these members of parliament are waiting for. What were they waiting for all these years? When this project was started, initiated, and step by step has been progressing until recently, when finally the final investment decision was taken and the Total and others started putting real money in the project. Why did they wait until such a time to start passing resolutions? Why did they intervene earlier? That is why it smells nasty, it smells horrible, and I don't think this is good faith.
That being the case now, what's the way forward? Does the Uganda government intend to put the project on hold for a year?
We will continue. We will not listen to these individuals. We will continue unabated with this project. We will continue engaging the Europeans and those who want to listen to us that this resolution is wrong and we should progress. We will do everything possible within our means to ensure that this progress continues. This progress gives us an enormous opportunity to leapfrog the poverty that our people are in, to leapfrog the social challenges that we're facing, to leapfrog ICT technology and other things that we cannot afford at the moment, and to put us on an equal footing with many of those countries. We cannot afford to be left to afford to step backwards simply because the Europeans want to continuously rule us either directly or indirectly. So we are not going to give up. We're going to use all means to try and ensure that this project continues, including even if the Total decides to withdraw, I am sure we can find alternative countries who are willing to come and help us develop our progress, our petroleum industry. And if those, if it comes to that, and we have to look for other alternative friendly countries to assist us, then all further decisions will be based on where who should be with us at a time of need.
That was Henry Okello Oryem, Uganda's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, in charge of international affairs. I reached him in Kampala.
Direct from Washington, the voice of America, VOA.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa made his first visit to the White House on Friday, where he and U.S. President Joe Biden discussed global security, climate change, trade, food security and health, and African nations' reluctance to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
South Africa's president made his first visit to the White House on Friday, more than 4 years after he took office. President Joe Biden said the U.S. values its relationship with the Rainbow Nation.
We have a lot to talk about. There's a lot happening around the world, not only on the continent of Africa, but around the world that you're engaged in as well. So welcome, looking forward to our conversation, and thanks for taking the time to be here.
Biden also fondly recalled meeting Nelson Mandela, the man who led the charge to end the racist apartheid regime. Mandela became the nation's first democratically elected leader in 1994. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, who is staring down a tight party leadership race as he nears the end of his first term as president, made his priorities clear too.
Really welcome the opportunity to be here so that we can extend those relations and we can get more companies to invest in South Africa to create jobs. We're also here to say thank you for the support that the United States gave to South Africa and to the African continent with regards to fighting COVID-19, the vaccines that you made available.
administration officials acknowledged that the leaders had sensitive topics to discuss privately. Just hours before the meeting, Ramaphosa publicly criticized pending U.S. legislation that seeks to monitor Russian activities in Africa, saying the bill seems to punish those who hold independent views by not joining the U.S. in condemning Russia's invasion of Ukraine. VOA asked the White House if this was the intent of the bill. John Kirby of the National Security Council.
The United States isn't making anybody choose between us and somebody else, either whether it comes to Ukraine or in the Indo-Pacific region. We respect sovereignty.
Analysts say the two nations need each other right now. International relations professor John Stremlaw of the University of the Witwatersrand spoke to VOA via Zoom from Johannesburg.
It's a very critical moment for both countries. They're both terribly divided and narrowly divided, so that I think they can help each other. And that's at the more subtle level than the agenda that is publicly announced, which is very important, not only important for South Africa, but for Africa.
Ramaphosa leads a diverse, resource-rich nation that faces serious challenges, but that has a passion for equality, a knack for beating great odds, and a talent for cheerfully meeting any problem head-on by making a plan. On Friday, the two leaders retreated from their boisterous, outspoken populations to talk about how to make a plan together. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
Former Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika has come under criticism following his call for current President Lazarus Chakwera and his government to resign. The call follows a sharp rise in goods and services, as well as foreign exchange and fuel shortages across the country. At a recent press conference, Mutharika said the prevailing economic crisis shows the administration appears incapable of addressing the myriad of challenges facing the country. But critics say the former president is not the right person to call on the government to resign. They accuse him of failing to resolve what they say are glaring leadership failures and divisions within the main opposition Democratic Progressive Party. For analysis and latest political development, VOA's Peter Clote reached Jorge Firi. He's a former lecturer at the University of Livingstonia in Malawi.
The reaction here is just normal because they understand Peter Mutharika very well. He faced similar challenges except the issue of fuel. But he never resigned when even civil society organizations called to him to resign for failing to meet the expectations of the general public or Malawians. But he didn't resign. Now they are wondering why Peter Mutharika is calling for the resignation of the president at this time when he himself failed to resign when he was the president.
Some of his supporters are saying he was right in calling out the government because the government promised to resolve a lot of the issues that it is confronted with, and that failure to do that is failing to keep promises made to Malawians, for which reason they elected President Chakwera and the Tonse Alliance. So isn't his call legitimate?
I agree with him on that. But is he the answer to the problems Malawians are facing now? That's where now Malawians are saying, no, you are not the one to give us the solutions on these, because you also failed when we called for you to resign. You failed. You didn't resign, and you also never resolved these challenges. They were, except the fuel thing during his time was not there, and except during his brothers. Now people are wondering, where has he got this wisdom now that he can resolve the challenges that he failed when he was the president? You know, he's confusing a lot of people, including members of his own party.
Talking about his own party, some political analysts have said that the main opposition party could fall apart, and that there are several camps within the opposition party that do not necessarily want him to lead the party anymore because his leadership, they said, has expired. Do you foresee this happening? Because some people even suggest that failure of the opposition party to hold accountable the present administration is a dent on Malawi's democracy. Your take?
I agree with that idea. Very true. And that's why I wish Peter Mutharika had first of all sorted out the problems he has in his own party, he could have a very good stand, because his, you know, Peter Mutharika is the president of a political party, not a civil society organization. But the issues that he is now bringing in are issues of civil society organizations, not of a political party, because as a leading opposition political party, he has a forum in the National Assembly, in Parliament, where his leader of opposition was supposed to get government to account for what they are failing to deliver right in Parliament, and change the policies and legislations for the better of Malawians. That is very official position, that if he had used it, Malawians would have rallied behind him and would have supported him very well. But he is speaking from outside, and in Parliament he is not opposing the same things that are taking place in government.
Do you think the former president achieved his main objective, for which reason he held the press conference to call on the Tonse Alliance, led by President Dr. Lazarus Chakwera, to resign? Did he achieve that aim?
He didn't. He didn't, because Malawians are no longer listening to him, including members of his party, and they are even laughing at him. It's just unfortunate that you cannot get the contacts of all the people. They are just laughing at him from the same party, because he is using a wrong podium to fight the good fight. The fight is good, but he is using wrong powers, wrong podium to fight the battle. He needed, at this point, he needed to corroborate with his leader of opposition and fight government right in Parliament, as they change the laws of this country and the policies in order to redeem the country from the crisis in which we are. Because Malawi now is a country of crisis.
That was Kirogi Firim, a former lecturer at the University of Livingstonia in Malawi. He was speaking with my colleague Peter Klote. The death of Britain's Queen Elizabeth II has sparked renewed debate in many Commonwealth countries, and most of them are former British colonies, about their future ties to the monarchy. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Britain isn't alone in having a new king. Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and Jamaica are among 14 other nations where King Charles III is the new head of state. 56 countries are members of the Commonwealth, an association of mostly former British colonies, with Charles at its head. Sonia Stanley-Nia is from the University of the West Indies in Jamaica.
Many countries have really been considering their own role, their own place in the Commonwealth. And I think that now that Queen Elizabeth has passed, there is going to be certainly more of a move to disassociate themselves from the Commonwealth.
Australia's Prime Minister wants a referendum on removing the British monarch as head of state in the next Parliament. The Caribbean states of Antigua and Barbuda and St. Lucia have expressed similar plans. The Bahamas this week said such a referendum was possible. A poll taken in August before the Queen's death showed 56% of Jamaicans favour removing the British monarch as head of state. Last year, Barbados became a republic, severing ties with the British monarchy. Guy Hewitt is the former Barbados High Commissioner to Britain.
I made the point that Barbados's journey to republic was not a rejection of the Queen or of monarchy, but more so than an affirmation of a right towards self-determination.
This year, Togo and Gabon, both former French colonies in Africa, joined the Commonwealth. That shows it is not in decline, argues Hewitt.
Charles, as the new head of the Commonwealth, worked closely with his mother, as the Prince of Wales, traveled extensively around the Commonwealth, as in his own right, championing causes like sustainable development and environmental protection.
Intrinsic to the debate is the legacy of colonial rule. Britain and other European nations enslaved millions of Africans until the 19th century, forcing them to work on plantations in the Caribbean and the Americas. Bert Samuels is from the Reparation Council of Jamaica.
This Commonwealth of Nations, that wealth belongs to England. That wealth is something we never shared in. So for us in Jamaica, the monarchy is a harsh reminder of our unfortunate past.
The monarchy has expressed sorrow over colonial abuses, but Britain has not formally apologised. Again, Sonia Stanley Nia of the University of the West Indies.
An apology is necessary. We must see remorse, and we must see a time when reparations become important in the ways in which we move forward as former colonies.
That apology should come from the British government, argues Hewitt.
There is a need for those colonial powers to take responsibility for what they have done. But in the case of the head of the Commonwealth or the king of the United Kingdom and its other realms, that's not their constitutional responsibility.
Many analysts agree that respect for Queen Elizabeth II bound the Commonwealth together. With a new king at its head, the organisation's future is less certain. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
A survey in South Africa shows more than half of graduates are considering moving to another country because of few opportunities at home. Business Unity South Africa, which represents the private sector, says they are seeing the lowest levels of confidence in the country's future since World War II. Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town, South Africa.
The survey was conducted by the Social Research Foundation, which calls itself a startup think tank. Its director, Franz Cronier, dismissed social media criticism, which said it is funded by the main opposition Democratic Alliance Party. Cronier said they are privately funded and not affiliated with any organization. He says his pollsters surveyed just over 3,000 people.
On the question of immigration, what it identifies is that roughly a quarter of adult South Africans are considering immigration, and that figure rises pretty steeply as you go into the top echelons of the skills base. So university graduates' figure comes in at around 50%. And also top earners.
Cronier says the immigration figures are in line with other public opinion research the foundation has recently conducted.
And this is all very consistent with broader public opinion data on South Africa, which shows that in response to tough economic circumstances and an increasingly troubling outlook towards the political future of the country, levels of concern about the long-term future have hit rates that I haven't seen in 20 years of doing this stuff.
Joshua Jacobs has been looking for a job since graduating from college last year. He's considering immigrating to Vietnam or South Korea to teach English, even though it's not what he studied.
It's quite dire at the moment. It doesn't look like there's an opportunity yet. I have a few friends who've already gone over, and like based on what they are experiencing, it seems like way more viable than being here.
Jacob says he studied for 3 years and graduated with a degree in human resources management.
I've been looking more or less in my field, but no luck there. It's a weird position that I'm in because when I started studying, the market was a bit better in terms of HR. Whereas now, it doesn't seem like there's the same opportunities. And the ones that there are, the pay has decreased and the experience needed is now increased.
Bonang Mohale, president of Business Unity South Africa, says he thinks it's regrettable that a country cannot hold on to the future workers in whom it's invested so much. He asks what will happen if graduates leave in droves.
The economy is already on its knees. It will further exacerbate the condition.
The Social Research Foundation is planning follow-up research. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
Officials in Cameroon say armed separatists have chased several thousand children from schools just days after the students returned to classrooms for the first time in years. Troops sent to restore school security in the western regions say they have killed at least 13 rebels in clashes over the last month. Moki Edwin Kinzikam is embedded with the troops near the town of Mbaoda, Cameroon, and has this report.
At a parking lot in Buda in Cameroon's west province, hundreds of people, mostly merchants and school children, are waiting for troops to take them to Bamenda, capital of the northwest region. Cameroon's military says separatist attacks this month on western villages, mostly on schools, sent thousands of school children, teachers and villagers fleeing for safety. Lingala Prudence is among students who on Monday fled Kumbu, an English-speaking town in the northwest region. The separatist conflict has disrupted her education so often that the 21-year-old who should be in college is still trying to finish high school.
We were in school and some people brought guns and then chased us out of the school and kidnapped some teachers. And all the students are out of school.
Teachers' associations say the Anglophone rebels are targeting state schools, which they view as a tool of the French-speaking majority's rule. But they are also attacking religious and private schools. Joe Chemuntu is coordinator of the Parent Teachers Association for Presbyterian Schools in Cameroon. He says separatist attacks and threats have shut down scores of schools that had reopened, some for the first time in years, when the school year started on September 5.
Many schools have shut down given the intimidations that are coming from separatist fighters. Teachers, learners, and school managers are afraid to get into full swing activities because it is unpredictable. You can't say what will happen the next minute. Some teachers have even had their arms amputated. Students have been kidnapped and they continue to kidnap teachers, students, and others, asking for ransom.
Cameroonian military spokespersons weren't allowed to speak with reporters on a trip to the area, but they did confirm that hundreds of troops were deployed to restore security so classes can resume. The military says the separatists also declared a lockdown in the English-speaking western regions that paralyzed trade. Separatists that declared the lockdown say it is in response to a government ban on community schools that the rebels control. Capo Daniel is a self-declared deputy defense chief of the Ambazonia Defense Forces, ADF, one of the largest rebel groups in Cameroon. He says the ADF is not in favor of the lockdown called by other rebel factions.
Misguided forces that are imposing this lockdown target innocent civilians who have largely rejected this lockdown. So for the most part, our people stayed at home out of fear. It is the responsibility of everybody who speaks for the Ambazonian Liberation Movement to ensure that our students access community schools, religious schools, and private schools that have been allowed and authorized by us to open.
Cameroon in August closed more than 200 community schools that rebels said they controlled. The military says in the past week, troops killed at least 13 rebels during clashes in the towns of Kumbu, Oku, and Dop. Rebel spokesman Daniel confirmed their fighters were killed and said they also killed government troops. Cameroon's military did not confirm any fatalities but said a few troops were wounded. Cameroon's Anglophone rebels want to create a breakaway state they call Ambazonia, separate from Cameroon's French-speaking majority. The UN says the rebel conflict has killed more than 3,300 people and displaced more than 500,000 since fighting broke out in 2017. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Buda, Cameroon. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Douglas Impoga, in Washington. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
I think it's dead. ask them, them know me. I know they blow trees, only low give me low. Music chose me, just know this and know me. I did lucky, but I'm never lonely. Sexy ladies, come wine for me slowly.
Ololademi Asake.
I'm a logo, but it's so cool. But you should do that, or Tanyoko. And well, Nibel, Nimoko, Moiko, Apollo, Living Beko. Say, we don't like designer. I be no like to Gapa. If you get a gatti gaga, you got to shop at it.
Here we go.
Palazzo, Gigi, Boya, for the easy. Who's sleeping, no one who's learning. Cow, it's a Yaka, or Yaru. My Gio, Shamo, Yaru. Put the game at our own time. Eva, Shamu.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline Africa team, we say thank you for joining us tonight. For more African news and features, visit our website at voafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. I'm your host, Douglas Impoga, in Washington, wishing you a very good evening.